A quick note before we start. About 70% of all people who listen to the show on Apple or Spotify don't follow the podcast. If you like the show, please hit that follow button. It ensures that you don't miss an episode, and it really helps spread awareness of the conversations we're having. And if you can leave a comment or a rating, that's even better. Thank you. Okay, let's get back to the show.
I'm Andrew Kitley, and this is my podcast, The Invisible Gift, a show about turning disability into possibility. From a young age, I was told I had a disability that would make it impossible for me to achieve and flourish in life. I struggled in school and felt I was not truly understood or supported. On my long road to becoming the owner of multiple businesses, I have learned that dyslexia was not my disability, but rather my invisible gift. My dyslexia challenged me every day, but it was also what made me into an independent thinker, a creative, and gave me that hard-working mindset that has taught me to never be discouraged by failure. I realised there are many people out there just like me. So I wanted to learn more about them and how we can all transform our greatest challenge into our invisible gift. Welcome to my podcast. James, so we're coming towards the end of the season now.
We are. This is our last meetup at the podcasting studio that we record at.
Yep, and we've been talking long and hard about what we're going to do with the podcast, and we've got some excited changes coming. One, the fact that you won't have to wait 6 months to get to the next season.
And I think that's really important. We need to keep on a roll now. We need to keep this momentum going. So we'll take a couple of weeks hiatus after this, but we should be back on the airwaves probably only 2 or 3 weeks.
Yep. And that's I think that's going to be really important, because that way it keeps the story going, the development, the kind of the evolution of the podcast.
You're on a journey for sure since we began to hear. And I think the listeners were able to tell that. And hopefully they are now on this journey with you.
Yeah. And I hope I sound a lot better than I did in season one.
Talking about that journey, last week on the show, you chatted to Kane Dowell from Ask Mummy and Daddy, the sweets and confectionery company. They kindly brought some sweets, which was great.
And now my jeans don't do up.
You talked about how he came from working for Kath Kidston.
Yeah.
And then has built his first business. And you talked about the challenges, some challenges around money. You talk about the importance of knowing when you've outgrown your founder. It's a really interesting episode, especially for people thinking about venturing into business, but maybe also who are neurodiverse. If that's your bag and you haven't listened to it yet, go back and listen to last week's episode when you get a minute. But for today, the focus is on Nathan Whitbread, the neurodivergent coach.
Yeah, it was great speaking to Nathan. He's so confident. Again, I thought, you know, this has been a season of confident people. And, you know, I've rarely meet anyone that I think out-confidence me on a real level. I mean, there's fake confidence and there's real confidence. And one thing I pride myself in is being able to read people. And Nathan was confident. But I suppose, being a coach, that's what you've got to be, right?
So according to my notes, the neurodivergent coach provides consulting, coaching and assistive technology training for dyslexic and neurodivergent individuals and teams.
Yeah, he had a real good insight into how it works with employers and the workforce with neurodivergence, and the fact that with the right structure and the right technology, you can really change around teams.
Now, we mentioned last week in the episode that the main focus was going to be around how and why neurodiversity has finally become sexy.
Yeah.
I can't wait to hear about that. You also talk about what neurodiversity really means in Nathan's take on it. And you identify why the best leaders work for their employees, not the other way around.
Let's take a listen.
So Nathan, thank you for coming on the show.
Pleasure. Pleasure.
Can you introduce yourself to the audience?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Nathan Whitbread. I am a coach. So I work with people in the workplace. I do coaching for all sorts of stuff. But one of the areas that I've ended up specialising in a bit is neurodiversity in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And that's working with people who would describe themselves as neurodivergent, working with leaders who manage neurodivergent staff and leaders who are neurodivergent, in order to help them be their most effective at work, I guess is probably the best way to describe it on that sort of macro level. And there's a whole world of detail underneath that.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you, your company is, you're a neurodivergent coach, right? So you go to companies and speak to people?
Yeah.
So how does that work?
Yeah, so it's all sorts, really. So some of it's around awareness, raising awareness of what neurodiversity is and what it means to be neurodivergent. But the majority of my work is actually working with individuals on how to take what they've got to be the best they can be. Amplifying their strengths and helping them manage some of the things they find a bit more difficult or challenging in the workplace, which is quite a common sort of theme. And that's generally comes at crisis points. So that might be around change or promotion or new job role, where possibly what we would describe as coping strategies, the kind of strategies or the way people do stuff have had to change. And for lots of people who would describe themselves as neurodivergent, that often causes a lot of anxiety, and they need a little bit more time. And sometimes what I describe as a bit of an MOT to help them get on track so they can be their best self at work.
So what made you want to do that? You're dyslexic yourself, right?
Yeah. So the story started for me when I signed up to do a qualification of all things after sort of, I would guess, blagging it through school and university. I decided to do a marketing qualification. And when I signed up for the course in my true gung-ho style, I hadn't really thought about how it was going to work. And they told me, are you going to be doing these essay style assessments? And that's something I'd avoided my whole life. I did engineering as a degree and managed to kind of avoid that for quite a long time.
Yeah.
So I spoke to my better half, my wife, and she sort of said, well, actually, you do recognise that maybe the way you think and the way you process is slightly different. And would it be an opportunity to go and find out if there was something actually different about you that you could get some more time or a different approach? So I went off and had a diagnostic assessment, and it came back I was dyslexic. And I never forget when the bloke told me, he said, well, at least you're not thick, but there's this kind of massive which is good to hear, isn't it? But there was this huge disparity between the person he was speaking to and the person that he saw on paper. And I think that was probably the thing that jumped out. And lots of people talk about that as a spiky profile or whatever you want to call it. But that was the kind of start of my journey. So, and from that, I basically rolled forward and managed to get some help. I had some coaching support and some bits of help in terms of technology and work. And I think I recognised pretty quickly that was really good, and that was something I wanted to be involved in. But there was an opportunity to do something different as well in terms of the way it was delivered, because a lot of the support at that time was very academic based. So it was kind of like teachers saying to you, "Let me teach you how to be better at this," as opposed to someone saying, "Well, actually, I've been there. I've walked the walk in the workplace. Here's some of the things you maybe need to think about." Because this is just bigger than, it's kind of bigger than just surviving. Do you know what I mean? It's about flourishing. So it's like, what's your experience? What's been good for you? What are the things I need to think about? How do I express myself best? How do I move forwards? So that's kind of how I got into this and sort of started moving in this field.
Have you personally seen a lot of growth recently in the conversations around neurodiversity in the workplace?
Yeah. It's become sexy now, hasn't it? Let's face it. It's sexy. It's interesting. It's the new kind of glittery thing. Definitely. I think there's a lot more interest, which is a double-edged sword, you know?
Yeah.
Because raising awareness is good. I think that's healthy. Mm. But we all need to watch out for the snake oil. I think that's the thing.
Do you know what? I'm actually glad to have this conversation, because I've been dying. Obviously, it's a sensitive area that people talk about, but I've been dying to get real with someone about this for a while. And I've been talking to people quite a lot about this. And one of my pet peeves in life is people taking something good and just using it and actually taking away from the people that actually need the help. So I've used this as an example a few times, but it's one that really annoys me, is like the people go, that's just my OCD, when there's actually people out there in an utter mess trying to deal with their OCD issues, but the people kind of write off their whimsical charms as something it's not. And I constantly worry now, especially speaking to more and more people, that neurodiversity is going to become this new thing, this new, like you say, sexy thing.
Well, I think there's a good, probably the important thing to start with, Andrew, is what neurodiversity actually means, because this is where it, I think it starts to get a bit complicated, because neurodiversity has got its roots in autism, yeah? Judy Singer, when she and Harvey Bloom, when they sort of coined the phrase, that's where neurodiversity was born out of, that kind of idea of what it was. But we, the language has moved on. So I would argue now neurodiversity is really everybody, because we're all neurodiverse. We all think differently, but then within that, you've then got a subset of people who are what you would describe as neurodivergent. And what I mean by that is they think significantly differently because of either a medical reason, it could be something acquired potentially. I mean, you could really have the PTSD banner coming in here and other things. So so that's important, I think, to kind of, first of all, when you start to talk about it. But you're right. Specifically with autism, for example, to say something is a bit autistic is very disingenuous. I mean, our eldest son is actually got an autistic diagnosis. And for him, he's even noticing in that self, because he describes who he is and people say, well, you're not very autistic. And it's like, you haven't got a clue what it's like, you know, because actually for him, there's some big gigs going on, actually, with it doing everyday life that he manages really well, but he holds it together and he blows out other times. And it's the same for lots of... you're right. I think that stereotyping, that idea that you can put a label on it. I think the thing I reflect on about that, I don't know about you, but, you know, for lots of people, their first experience of an autistic person was either Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man or the guy who was the accountant, you know. And actually, neither of them particularly represent it well, because they're both extremes and they're both unique. But that doesn't mean that's autism in any way, shape or form.
No, and I think the term autistic spectrum is probably the best word you could actually use for it, because it is a huge spectrum in the fact that you can have it really severe, or there's milder cases of it.
Absolutely. And the other thing to consider as well, Andrew, is the environment, because I think one of the things I'm really struck by is lots of us become disabled by our environments. And what I mean by that is that you can be operating absolutely brilliantly when you're safe and you're at home and you've got people that get you and you can perform really well. But if you move into an alien environment where actually the very things that push your hot buttons aren't being addressed, then suddenly you've taken someone who is really able, capable, and can potentially offer something really fantastic to a workplace, is suddenly completely disabled by their environment, because they're scared, they're feeling lonely, and, you know, and actually possibly they're having sensory overload or something like that's going on, just because no one's bothered to actually ask them what's going on and how they can help them.
How do you think we solve that problem?
I think it's not straightforward, but I do think it starts with good conversations. And I think it's also, and it has to happen from both sides. First of all, from the employer, needs to think quite carefully about how they create an environment where it's okay to not be okay. People can actually have conversations. And that happens throughout the life cycle within a job. Because what we're seeing at the moment, which is good, is that there's lots of energy going around creating schemes, particularly for what you would describe as neurodivergent individuals to come into the workplace, i.e. recognition of maybe particular traits that are good. But making sure that recognition carries on through the life cycle, that person within an organisation, that even once they become a senior director, they can still stick their hand up and saying, I'm not coping because of X, Y and Z, I need some help here. And that to be okay, I think, is probably the key component.
Having this conversation in the last like 4 or 5 weeks, this is the third season, and we've gone a lot more into the workplace environment this time. I found that most of the stuff that everyone's coming on saying actually doesn't just benefit neurodiverse people, it benefits everyone. It's really interesting how kind of like the diversity in using your skill set within your own limitations and really focusing on what you're good at and having a supportive environment, and like you say, putting your hand up saying I'm not all right. Don't you think that just benefits everyone generally?
It's mega, isn't it?
It almost feels like, why haven't we been doing that? Why has things not moved to that point already, right?
I mean, that's a really interesting observation. I suspect there's a bit of this is the way it's always been done around here that we're still dealing with. a good way I like to think about it is in terms of, I mean, when people talk about religion, you know, in terms of there's a difference between faith and religion. And what I mean by that is faith is like believing and following something. Religion is just doing what you've always done, and then
yeah.
and then it doesn't always yeah. nourish. And
good analogy.
And I think we get that in the workplace as well. We just do stuff. I mean, recruitment's a classic example. How many people run the same recruitment process, you know, where they say, right, send us your CV, turn up, we want you to do an interview with three people and a presentation, but I'm signing up to be a cleaner. But that's not the point. We need you to do the presentation. It's just like, why don't you give people tasks to do when they do their recruitment so you can actually see how well they perform on the job? I mean, because you've got a scaffold in business. Is that right, Andrew?
Structural engineer.
Sorry. Apologies. But no, you can imagine, though, if you interviewed a scaffolder asking them to do a presentation as opposed to putting some scaffolding up. I'm yeah, just saying.
They wouldn't be very happy about it.
Well, exactly. If you get the idea. Yeah, I'm just thinking about where that fits.
Yeah, but actually, it's quite funny. So my wife applied for a bank. I won't mention who. and again, they probably all have similar things. And she's in kind of market and advertising industry. Right. And she'd done they do a personality test.
Yeah.
Probably based on Briggs and Myers.
Myers, yeah.
And they did get in because of her answers, but they didn't say why.
Yeah.
So obviously they're looking for a certain sort of person.
Yeah.
And you can't really dictate your answers. You can't work your answers into a way that would work because they're not good or bad answers. They just sum up who you are. But that, why I said that interview process is a real interesting one because you don't even know where you're getting to. And I find a lot of things with recruitment these days is when you're applying for a job, you don't really get the feedback anyway. And especially for neurodiverse people, you don't know how you've done well. And because we've been through a life cycle of failing a lot, we like to know where we've gone wrong and how we can improve on it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you found that yourself. I've always wanted to know what I've done badly so I can change it. And I always say to my clients, if we've cocked up, tell me, because I can't make anything better unless you tell me.
Well, feedback's brilliant, isn't it? Especially when it's good quality feedback. Yes, you trust. I mean, that's the other thing as well, isn't it? But I think you're right. And that recruit, I mean, you're talking about psychometric testing there. And there's a big split about this because what is that psychometric test testing for? Because actually, I mean, using the example of your wife, I mean, she may be coming into a team. And actually, there's this whole thing. I mean, I read this book recently that really challenged my thinking. Called The Medici Effect. So it's quite a famous book. It's been around for years. But it's just talking about that intersection of ideas. And that thing about, and some of the stuff that Matthew Syed had sort of talked about in terms of what we do, our natural reaction is to get people who are like us because we think that's good. So if you've got a great idea, you go, well, I've got a great idea. Let's get a team together. What I want is people who are like me. Because they make me feel comfortable because they're going to tell me how brilliant I am and we're going to get on brilliantly. We're going to go down the pub. We're going to have a great time. But actually, if we want to move stuff forward, we don't want people like us. We want people who are different. And the reason why we want people who are different is not just because they bring something different, but they've got a whole network of people we would never even dream of knowing that they can bring to the party. And that's what makes innovation and brilliant things happen.
I have a rule not to employ anyone like me. There is a strict rule. I don't need two of me in the business.
Absolutely.
One is quite enough to be a problem. But actually it's interesting, in my last business there was a few people in there like me.
Yeah.
And it was a joint business with someone else, and the people we employed was a mixture, but you could tell where I was logging heads with some of them.
Yeah.
And interestingly, so one of my mentors once said to me, if two directors think the same, one of you isn't needed.
Yeah.
So I have this now where my whole team, who probably can hear this in the other room, are so far opposite to me, but they do all the stuff that I'm terrible at, they're really good at. And I think that is where it works really well. And because we think so vastly differently from each other, it is always a varied opinion on everything.
Yeah, and it's great because the first thing you need to have is to have that, and then the next part of it is then to make sure that's okay, i.e. there's going to be a conversation that follows that says, I hate what you said there, Andrew, but I respect you enough to take it seriously and work out how do we move forward on this.
Yeah. Well, this is kind of like, again, I heard some, I don't know, it was once said, I think it might have been Simon Sinek, said, I used to view things very differently when I was younger, but I I used to always think if I owned the business, I was in charge and that's how things were and I could be the boss. Now I kind of take the view that they work for our clients and I work for them.
Yeah.
And as soon as I change that view, whenever they come back to me and said, oh, I'm not doing something properly, or I need to do this, I just took it like the, like I need, my only job is to help them do their job. That's it. I don't try and tell them what to do. And I think that works really well.
It also comes under that brilliant principle that the most important job of a manager is to develop their staff and make themselves expendable because their staff are good enough to do their job for them.
Well, I think there was another story. It was probably in a book. And the problem is I don't ever remember the name of any book.
That's all right.
They were just mashed together. it was a story about a guy went on a business conference. There's lots of really top CEOs from all over the world that went to this conference. And they were away for 3 days. And the rule was you couldn't have your phone out. And anyway, on the last day, they were all leaving, saying their goodbyes. They're all turning on their phones and they're having like thousands of emails and missed calls come through and stuff like that. And they're all kind of gloating about how many missed calls they've got and how many emails they've got. And his observation was, surely the least you have means you're doing your job properly. If you've got all these emergency calls and you're having to deal with everything and all this is drawing through, you obviously haven't set up your business to not need you.
Yeah, and the big question is, why have you done that?
Yes. Ah, I love that you picked up on that. Yes, because that's what I always say, isn't it? There's normally a very deep-seen reason why.
Are you prepared to let this business go and move on and do something better?
Andrew, we were talking before this recording, and we got onto the topic that you've just been talking about what it says about you as an entrepreneur if you build a team that can't function without you.
Yeah, it's a sore subject for me because it irritates me when I hang around with other founders and they talk about how everything will collapse if they're not there, and I'm like, that's not a point to celebrate. That should be a problem.
Hi everyone. I just have a quick announcement that I'm really excited to share. We're launching the Invisible Gift Community, a platform designed to provide support and resources for neurodivergent individuals. I've always been passionate about sharing conversations around being neurodivergent, raising awareness and promoting understanding, but I want to do more. So now the Invisible Gift website will offer a range of tools and resources to help neurodivergent individuals navigate the challenges any one of us can face on a daily basis. This includes information about workplace accommodations, tips for managing sensory overload, advice on how to communicate effectively, information for how to get the most out of a neurodivergent child's education, as well as providing the building blocks for them to have a successful life and much more. But to do this, we need your input. We are looking for therapists, influencers, business leaders, HR, and brand representatives to provide their input and support. If you're one of these people that wants to support neurodivergence, or if you just believe you can really help out, send my team an email on hello@theinvisiblegift.com and you can find more information on the Invisible Gift website. With your help, we can really turn neurodiversity into possibility. Okay, back to the show.
Coming up, you talk about why you need people to identify as individuals and not as groups, which is an interesting idea. And Nathan explains the term neurowashing to us. That's a new one on me.
Yeah.
But first, you asked Nathan more about who he works with as the neurodivergent coach, and this is what he had to say.
So do you work with individuals or companies or both?
Yeah, I mean, as a coach, I work with individuals and companies, actually. I mean, the majority of the work, just because I tend to focus on the workplace, which is a hurdle in itself, I get that, but that's just kind of where I've kind of focused, is people I work with are employed generally. So that's it's generally with organisations, and as I say, there's two components to it. It's working with the individual within the organisation, but then there's actually working with larger groups of people, because I think there's a real power as well when you start to work with groups to help them understand their own dynamics and their own strengths, and start to get their head around what it means to work together cohesively and collaboratively. Especially when you start to talk about neurodivergent traits and bring that into the equation as well.
It's funny, people seek, now because I've done this podcast and I do a few little talking events and stuff like that, and there's certainly more coming. People ask me for advice, and do you know what? I'm not the best person to ask for advice for this. I keep on telling The thing is, I speak to people, like half the people I speak to are just like me. They're just talking about their story. Whereas the other half are absolute brilliant people like yourselves trying to really change things. I'm like, you should, when people say to me, so what do you think I should do about this? I'm like, no, go and see someone that knows. You know, I'm happy to give my opinion, but don't take me as.
But that's really important, Andrew, because I think that's us coming back to, sorry, to roll back a few questions when you talked about, you know, people entering the space and stuff. I think there's something really important about recognizing what's your own story and what's helpful for other people. And that's really powerful because your story's unique, yeah? Whether you want to call it your intersect or whatever it is, you know, the stuff that's come together that's made you who you are is absolutely unique. And yeah, there'll be bits there that's reusable, but some of it will just be down to that what's happened in those situations and the opportunities you've taken. And I think when we're working with individuals, it's so important that we respect their stories unique and then thinking about, well, what do they bring? And what are the bits they may be missing, and what are the bits that may be helpful for them to kind of progress to where they want to get to?
So for me, this season's been a bit of an eye opener because one of the things that, so every season has a theme. The first season was me learning what the hell all these different words mean in dyslexia. The second season was shockingly a lot about mental health around neurodivergence, and then this season's been about careers and how we get over the blockers in there, if there are any, and our views around that. But however, mental health keeps on coming back.
Yeah.
And a lot of people will contact me now and say, Andrew, how do you kind of get over this thing about mental health, confidence and stuff like that? And I keep saying to people, as much as I love to have an answer for that, that's too much of a big question for me, because I have to be honest, and I know everyone talks about mental health, I haven't had mental health problems around anything to do with neurodiversity or anything generally. I think I've been really fortunate in that. So I'm very reluctant to kind of give advice or even almost give my opinions in that, because I don't think I'm not lived it, so it's very hard for me to have an opinion on that.
I think that's very wise, to be honest with you, because I think there's a danger that we want to kind of give answers to things that we've got ideas about what we should be doing, but you can't. But I think particularly with the mental health stuff, it's a bigger conversation, because you want to find out their story and what's actually going on. Because you can't put sticking plasters on this stuff, because and when you talk about mental health as well, there's layers to it, which I'm sure you must have talked about a bit, you know, in terms of you've got diagnosis, but then you've just got people that are upset and are dealing with, you know, however you want to describe the last 2 years, because wherever you cut it, you know, it's been interesting for everyone, hasn't it? In terms of this huge sort of change in working patterns and styles, and, you know, all those people that have been told they could never work from home, and suddenly overnight they went home. And guess what? Yeah. The world still exists. Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. Well, do you know, I said many years ago, I think I saw a thing where Elon Musk talked about universal credit.
Yeah,
and AI, and one day that we wouldn't need to work; it would be a choice whether we work. And universal income, not universal credit. Universal income. And he said there's going to be a big problem with what people do with their lives. And I thought the issue would be mental health.
Yeah, massive.
And I think with what's happened over the last 2 years, it's brought it forward by about 10 years. And every time I have a conversation to anyone, not just around dyslexia or neurodivergence, but just generally, the mental health topic keeps on coming up so much. And before I wanted to try and avoid it on the podcast because I didn't know enough about it, and unless I got an expert on, it's coming up every single episode. And I was just wondering if you regularly get that question along when you do your mentorship, or do you cover anything in it?
Well, it comes up, certainly. People present with questions about their mental health, or they're describing what's going on with their mental health. I think particularly as a coach, I think you really need to understand the boundaries of what you are qualified to work with and what you're not. What I've noticed is that actually if someone has identified as having some mental health issues and they're engaged with a therapist, it makes coaching a lot easier because they've got somewhere to take stuff. when you get to those places where they need to take that to therapy as opposed to it being coaching. Because coaching specifically is about forward focus. It's always about forward focus. You're trying not to go, you don't want to go back unless that serves something forwards. So it's about where they're going to go next. What do they want to do? How can they move through something? How can they plan something? So if they've got, if there's something like a diagnosis involved, then they're working with someone who's working on that, then you can, then they can take that to there and you haven't got to kind of deal with that as a coach. But I think awareness of it's really key. Not being afraid to talk about it's really key as well. So for example, I have worked with individuals who've talked about suicide and things like that, which is obviously distressing because you just feel completely unempowered. I mean, what do you do when you're speaking to someone, it's Christmas Eve, and they tell you they actually want to take their own life, and you think, well, I might not see you again for or contact you. So I think there's something about actually talking about it and also being equipped to talk about it. So I've done a bit of mental health training myself, and some of the things that I've found really helpful is not being afraid to ask the questions.
Right.
So for example, if someone's making hints about stuff and you're the only person to talk to them, don't be afraid to ask them, well, what are your plans? Have you got a plan to do that? Who are you going to call? Who do I need to call if you don't call them? Or how are you going to let me know you've made a step forwards in that if you're concerned about them? I guess at the extreme end. But then at the more sort of, I guess, the more manageable end, the middle ground, you know, if you've got people who are talking about mental health around actually just coping, it's thinking about, well, actually, what are they doing with their life in terms of what are the things that give them joy, especially in a work context? What are the things that allow them to appreciate what they do well? So I'm going to give you an example. For me, actually, lockdown was quite challenging just because actually as soon as you had to go home and stay home, I like seeing people, you know. It's good. Yeah, it's a good thing, you know.
I'm an extrovert. I love seeing people. When I still can't get over most people. Like the handshaking seems to all but disappeared. I actually shook hands with another guest last week.
Brilliant.
I think she was quite shocked, but the thing is, I love either a handshake or if you're really comfortable with someone, a hug. For me, that human connection, that's really important. And I can't. That's just who I am. But you're right. I understand what you mean. I mean, especially being a public speaker, that must be a
especially if you're extrovert. So some of the things that I've worked personally on is just actually building some of the things that I need. So for example, we had a load of us in our road where we live, and we all run together at lunchtime quite often.
It's nice,
but it's essential in some ways, you know, when you're not seeing anyone else, you know. And you know, I got really into skipping over lockdown, and actually I found that as a really powerful thing. I'll tell you, skipping is amazing.
I love skipping, but it's just so funny how many people have got into skipping, because I do boxing, so I love skipping.
It's brilliant, isn't it? Well, I mean, if it's okay to plug someone, I mean, there's a guy called the jump rope coach, Chris, who's actually an autistic guy. He's an autistic guy, so he's a wonder. I mean, not that I've spoken to, but we've had a few emails. But his website and what he's done is amazing, because he's got this whole, you know, from just starting from nowhere right the way through to advanced. And I've followed a lot of his stuff and I love it. And it's just that idea you can do something like that and lose yourself in it. Because I challenge you to take a serious work problem out there with a skipping rope and come back without some insight, or you will at least completely manage to clear your brain to the point where you can come back and approach it anew. And that's what I found anyway.
All right, so I've got... If I don't go to I love the gym. And before, I kind of swapped my addiction. So I used to do martial arts 6 days a week. And I've done that since my parents put me in at the age of 5 to kind of calm me down.
Yeah.
So my ADHD didn't send me absolutely up the wall. And then I've done that all the way up to I was about 32. And then I swapped it for the gym. And I absolutely love the gym. But if I don't go, it affects everything in my life.
Yeah.
And I mean everything. I'm more grumpier. I'm a worse husband.
Yeah.
I'm a worse father. Yeah. You know, it's just, I'm not good. Even like this conversation wouldn't be as good as if I didn't go to the gym today.
It's almost like a power flush. I always think about like a bit of a power flush, you know. It's not like you radiate. You know, when you plug in the thing to wash all the rubbish out. That's kind of like going to the gym. It just kind of gets everything moving.
Yeah. And I feel like, I've got me, I, you're, you'd probably not do too well talking to me in the gym. I'm not a very sociable person. There's me say I'm an extrovert. Ask me a question in the gym, like how long I'm going to take. I'll turn into a beast. But that's my time for really switching off. It's just me and that. Do you know, I remember Nike done an advert, or it might have been on a film, where they'd done a video of like a woman running, and it was just her breathing and her heart, and it was just her on that road. And in that moment, it's kind of like basically saying it's just her on the road. And I feel like that at the gym. It doesn't matter if there's other people in the gym. I can literally cut everyone out.
Yeah.
And it's just my time. And I think for me, that's something that's helped me. And it with all the challenges, any challenges I've had in life, there's always been either martial arts or the gym.
And that's really important, Andrew, because some people don't have that. That's the thing to recognise. And they need help building that up, that kind of what that thing is they're going to go to.
I realised this through, first of all, I found out from I thought it was something to do with neurodiversity, but actually I find a lot of people I speak who are neurodivergent, if they don't have a passion or a hobby, it doesn't matter which way you want to put it, I find they always struggle a lot more than the people that do have that thing they go to, the moment they really enjoy, whether they're amazing at it or not. I would never say I was an amazing martial artist, but it was something that I absolutely loved doing. And whenever I felt shit, like when I was at school, whenever I couldn't do anything, I couldn't do exams, I couldn't go and compete and win, or I could go and just fight my heart out. And there was always improvement, and it was always measurable, and it was that passion. And I've got similar friends in neurodivergent that have it with music.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. It's just finding that, having that something to go to.
And I think also that there's something else about that as well, isn't it? Because you've talked about the fact you moved from martial arts to the gym. It's also being able to take the good stuff and move it to a different context sometimes. Because I think sometimes you get so fixated with what you love when that's not possible anymore. So for me, for example, when I went to university, I was on the verge of leaving university, and then someone introduced me to playing rugby. And I loved rugby. It was it's a brilliant game because there's two things I love about it. First of all, I love the fitness element, but also I love the tactical element. You know, the fact there's strategy to it. You know, I was fortunate enough. I'm quite a big guy, and I was much bigger then, but I was fit. Mm. But because I was fit and strong, I could play like a prop forward and run like a back.
Oh wow! that is a key thing.
Because I don't know if you've ever played rugby, but whenever you turn up to a rugby club,
loose head.
Oh, you're a loose head as well. Brilliant. But the thing is, when you go to a rugby club, you'll notice that there's always like 25 back row players, one prop, and a hooker. So actually, if you're prepared to say, "Well, that's my position," actually, you get a game at a good level. You haven't got to worry about mucking about with the other guys. But I was just quite struck that when that changed, my family came along, I couldn't play that game the way I wanted to, because I believe with rugby, really quite firmly, you have to play at quite a good level to be safe, actually, especially if you've got a bit of talent, because you just get targeted and it's not fun. So actually that's really important. So being able to transition to something else is really important, being able to take that passion to something different.
And I think to round that up, it's just, I think passions in all sense, especially people, like I said, if you've got passion, something you love, it's very easy to lose yourself in that. And then that helps you in all your other areas of your life. And I always, that is actually, when anyone comes to me for advice, even if they're starting businesses, I said, you just got to find your passion in whatever you do, because when you find that you are going to become a much happier person, and then the other bits of your life that are hard seem to get better.
Yeah, and I think that really reflects back into where we started with this conversation, actually. That finding passion in stuff is so important in the workplace. Because even in jobs that aren't great, you still got to find the things that you love, or at least be working towards the thing you really want to do.
Yeah, it's funny. I always say to people, I actually love getting up every day, and that's because I love my job. And I didn't used to love I kind of always loved the jobs I've always been in. When I was a scaffolder, I loved my job. And then when I started doing engineering, you find it's not actually the jobs, it's parts of your jobs. And I spoke about this to someone the other day on another podcast about how it doesn't need to be the whole job. It could be something in your job. So, for instance, I'm a structural engineer. The thing I love in my structural engineering, was problem solving. But when the company grew, my new passion within the company was the business side of it. I suddenly loved the business side of it. And in my previous jobs, I loved the sales side of the business. So it's not really, it doesn't have to be what you do. It's what you do with passion within a business.
And is there a theme of problem solving through that? Because, I mean, I've been working in sales myself. You know, sales is about solving problems for other people. Structural engineering is about solving problems, isn't it? And running a business is all about solving problems.
And that's exciting. But I think what's great is my kind of my dyslexia is something that I think help, that's why I say that helps with it, because failing and trying to learn how to do something more effectively is what I'm good at, because I spent so many years doing it. I can't do my maths homework, so I'm going to have to find a way around it. So I did. I paid someone to do it instead. But I'm not saying by all means don't. And
is this a spin-off business, by the way?
But it was just like I had to find a way to get out of it. Otherwise, I would never, by all standards, if you spoke to my teachers, they would have probably said I weren't that good. But my homework was always amazing. That's because I'd never done it. But I'm not advocating people do that. But that was a problem I had to solve then.
It's interesting though, isn't it, the tools we use, and that's I think another thing, especially, I mean, if you talk about dyslexia specifically, for some individuals that relational side is so strong and so powerful, yet so underrated if they don't release it.
Because
what people always fail to recognise, well, lots of people I should say fail to recognise, is they completely ignore the things they're great at and focus in on the things that they struggle with.
Isn't that mindset though?
Yeah, oh, totally. But it's a cultural thing. I mean, it's probably a bit of the old stiff upper lip British mindset, you know. We'll just make do and carry on. You know, I'm going to, you know, we focus on what we're rubbish at. And it's also a society thing as well. When was the last time we stepped out and said to someone, you're blinking brilliant at that?
Yeah, no, you're right. Do you know what? You made me feel guilty now. And I thought, oh, he's going
to
go out and tell us.
You're going to have to go around the office, aren't you?
No, but you're right.
It is, isn't it? It's really interesting, isn't it, as a culture? Because I think when you compare that with, I mean, not that I know a huge amount of American culture, but you think about it, especially around business and startup, you know, to fail is okay. It's expected. Fail early, fail small, move on. Yeah. Over here, it can sometimes be, that's it, mate. That's your last chance.
Yeah. And it's funny you say about, I was going to say that earlier when you were talking about the mental health thing. Yeah. You said about seeing therapists, and I have a big issue with our culture in the UK overseeing therapists, because it is deemed as you're a nut job. You don't do that. If I said to someone in this country, anyone I know, if they said to come to me and said, oh, I've got some problems, I'll say, why don't you go and see someone? They go, I'm not seeing anyone. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. But the thing is, though, if you're a top level sportsman, I love this. You know, the adjective, imagine you're Roger Federer and someone said to you, go and see your coach. You go, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. But this is the whole thing. We kind of alienate even like what you do for a living, having a coach. It's funny because I always say to people, I have mentors, and as I change in my life, I get different mentors depending on where I need to go to the next level. Some mentors will get you to the next place and then you need to go to the next. People think that's hilarious. Yet these are the same people that ask me for advice on how to do things.
And what are they asking you to do there? Exactly.
Yeah, I was like, are you asking me to be your mentor?
And you don't even want to pay me.
That's like literally what you're asking me to do, right?
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew. And the other thing that's really interesting here is, I mean, the distinction, and by the way, I'd just say the distinction between coaching and mentoring is just the fact that a mentor puts input in. They should do very similar things, because ultimately a lot of it's going to be driven by you, because you're the only one that knows your situation. But so that's why, I mean, although I would call myself a coach, there's genuinely quite often a mentoring angle to it, just because people will want you to offer stuff at certain times. But the thing I've learned about this whole thing is you offer little and you offer it late, because you let them develop their own story first and then see where you can add value to it, as opposed to trying to tell them what to do.
Yeah. I learned that the hard way. The first mentor I ever had, I asked them something, and they was like, I don't know, you tell me. And that was all they said all the time. I don't know, you tell me. But now I've moved along, and you're probably, I don't know if you'll probably agree with this. I don't know, maybe you
give us a whiz.
They always say to me, I'll say, oh yeah, I wanted to do this, but this. And they're like, who said that? You just, that's just saying you're putting out there. Where's that opinion come from? Like every time I say something's stopping me, they're like, well, that's your own thoughts about it.
But sometimes the externalization as well is the powerful thing, isn't it? I don't know if you find that. I mean, especially when you're because if you're, not I know a lot about your situation, but imagine if you're running an organization, there may be certain things that you can't externalize with your team because it's got massive implications potentially. And you need to think them through before you take it to them, just because you need to know where you're going. And that's where I think sometimes external coaching and mentoring can be really helpful, especially with someone you trust and you've got that whole confidence thing, because you can actually genuinely bounce and you can externalize it and you can hear what you're saying and actually work out, is that what I really want to do? Or do I just need to get it off my chest because it was a good idea that I had in the bath this morning that needs to stay in the bath? But you're making a really interesting point there as well, Andrew, didn't you? That whole, and I've been really struck by this over the last couple of years, actually how good we are really depends a lot on the people we put around us. I think.
Completely.
And I think there's just this massive fat lie we have to live with in our culture that there's all these Lone Ranger, John Wayne style gunslingers out there who are just knocking straight to the top all on their own. And it's not the reality. The reality is we're shaped by mentors, friends, coaches, confidences, acquaintances who inspire us, challenge us, really irritate us sometimes, but they help shape our direction and they form us. That's what I feel is really important, especially with neurodivergent individuals, is that they don't always get that support and help from the people that really can help them. And that's what I think's essential, because for anyone to develop well, we need people who we can look forward to, who can help shape us at different parts of the journey.
And that's why I believe that neurodivergent people do a bad job at thinking backwards and helping the people that are coming on behind them. And that's why I'm hoping it changes, because you've got people like myself and you and all the other guests I have on it that are trying to do amazing things. But then I think when you think one in 10, I don't know.
Probably even more than that, because that's just that. Yeah. Because you look at the stats. I think that's just the scratching the surface.
Yeah. Well, this is what I mean. But then I go to schools and speak to them and they say, well, all we've got to look up to is people like, I don't know, Richard Branson and stuff like that. And it's like, that's a billionaire. And it's true. What about Andrew down the road that's done well in life, but not, he's not a billionaire or an unattainable amount. But I think a lot of people, still don't see it as strengths in any way.
Yeah, I think there's still a big misconception there. And it's that, I mean, I did see something quite interesting the other day, because I think Lewis Hamilton, for example, is dyslexic, I think. And I was quite struck by a piece I saw that seemed to be suggesting that was somehow made him a better Formula One driver. Now, I would argue I'm not convinced that's the case. I think Lewis Hamilton is an exceptional driver who has trained hard, who has incredible talent and has actually put a lot of hard work in. I suspect his dyslexia plays a very small, and please feel free to challenge me, anyone who fancies that I'm wrong, but I think it's a very small component of what makes him a brilliant racing driver. I think the other thing to remember is dyslexia is an observed thing, isn't it? It's observing a certain collection of traits that have been formed under this idea of what dyslexia is. And with dyslexia specifically, you know, there's lots of different traits. Different ones are stronger in different people. I'd say probably the most common one that I come across is short-term memory, i.e. lack of it. But that's not true for everyone with dyslexia. And you're right. I think there is, you have to be careful, because actually you are a unique human being who happens to have a dyslexic diagnosis. And that's the things to hold on to. And that's why labels can be helpful, but also extremely dangerous, because what you don't want is someone to say, well, I've got a dyslexic diagnosis. Oh, great. I'm like Andrew then. I'm going to go and become a structural engineer. Just like, no, mate, it doesn't quite work like that.
Well, I always say that. I think we should strive to identify as individuals and not groups or labels, because that is when it becomes, because you kind of pigeonhole yourself and then you add more stress because you're not fitting into that narrative. And I always say to people that comes all down to self-awareness.
And honesty and authenticity.
I
totally.
And isn't that what makes us all great? Being unique in our own ways.
Yeah.
I mean, that's certainly what I like about people. If I had a group of friends that all thought exactly the same and had the same opinions, it wouldn't be a very good or interesting group of friends.
Absolutely. The key thing I think that's so important is that as a culture, we appreciate that and actually celebrate that and utilize it and don't just play lip service. Coming back to what you were talking about, I don't know if I coined it or whether I found it somewhere, but this idea of neurowash came from greenwash, you know, where we're just basically saying the right things but not doing anything different under the surface.
And do you know what? I'll probably say Western culture, we're very good at that. And that's something that we need to avoid as this is growing, because it is the kind of the diversity, we're in neurodiversity, other forms of diversity, the conversation is growing massively. It should definitely be more than conversation. It should be
action. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because actually, we'll know people by their actions, not by what they say.
Well, oh, that was beautiful. that was nice. I like that. So what would you say your invisible gift is?
I think probably tenacity, actually. Mm-hmm. I think if I had to put, you know, it's the opposite. Do you ever remember that film War Games?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Do you remember? And he said what he needed to teach the computer was futility. There's a time to just give up.
Yeah.
At the end. Do you remember?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's the exact opposite of that. It's that actually there is no time to give up.
No.
Because actually life's too precious.
Yeah. That's words after my own heart, because I just think, do you know what? I do wake up every day feeling how fucking lucky I am. And it's not really what I have or what I've achieved. It's more to do with just the fact that I'm here.
Do you know what I look forward to every morning, Andrew? Making porridge. I love it. Porridge has changed my life. I just love it. I know it's a stupid thing. I look forward to making it for my kids, because I know it's going to taste good, it's going to set me up, and it's going to keep me going all day.
What a great way to end.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
I tell you what, Andrew, I prefer Nathan's take on a good morning rather than Wim Hof's. Wim Hof thinks you should have a cold shower or get an ice bath. Nathan looks forward to making porridge every morning because, and I quote, it's going to taste good, it's going to set me up, and it's going to keep me going for the rest of the day. That is a lot more appealing to me than the cold shower.
Oh no, I like the cold shower idea.
Do you?
Yeah, I'm a big Wim Hof fan.
Have you tried it?
Yeah. So in the times I was training, and I'm going to admit to you guys right now, I haven't trained since Christmas. This is terrible. But so after every training session, I did a plunge ball. I'm sitting there. I love it.
Well, they do say, don't they, that if you have a cold shower in the morning, the first thing you do to be the cold shower, then everything else you do that day won't be as hard as the shower.
Yeah. Also, there's a lot to be said for, what do they call it, thermoregulation, which is hot, jumping between hot and cold. But I think we're properly digressing here.
We are already. We've only just started. What did you think about Nathan's invisible gift, which is his tenacity?
And do you know what? I think it's evident. I don't think you needed to answer that question, because there's one thing that you, well, that's what you want from a coach anyway, right? But he does. He is, I don't know how you say it in another form, but he has a lot of tenacity.
What is your take on neurowashing?
Well, yeah, I agreed with this, and I think, well, it was me that actually kind of brought this up. You've got to make sure you don't throw it into every sentence, and people aren't doing it for box ticking and making sure, you know, we've got to be very careful on how we do it.
And it's really interesting what he said about neurodiversity also including neurotypical people.
Yes.
And he's probably one of the first people, if not the first person on the pod since we began, who's talked about it in this kind of inclusive way.
So this is really interesting, and actually this is the one thing that we've not spoken about yet, James, but this is one thing we're going to be being very cautious of moving forwards, because a lot of developments happened in the neurodiverse world, but the conversation's now not just about the question is there such a thing as a neurotypical person? And you know, we all have different approaches to our work life and everything. It's going to need to be a conversation of how we all adapt our working environments for different ways of thought and the way things are implemented in the workplace. As we explained throughout some of the podcast series, that actually it's all a spectrum, and I don't think there's one person that fits into one group. And this is what we were talking about about identifying as a group, and it's very, you've got to be very careful with that, because that makes no sense. And when people identify as a group, there's a right and wrong, and that's not how the life should be. It should be every person's individual, and in some ways we all have certain things that we are good at and bad at, and reasons for that, and we need to embrace it. And that's, I suppose, that's fully embracing diversity in all its forms, because that's really what we're getting at, James, is making sure that diversity is really appreciated. And it's, we talk specifically into neurodiversity, but it actually goes into all forms of diversity.
And on that note, I think it's a really great way to wrap up this season. It sets us up perfectly for where we're going next.
Yes, it does.
Nathan, thank you so much for being the final guest of season 3 of the Invisible Gift podcast. If you guys want to check out more about Nathan and the great work he does, you can look at his website, theneurodivergentcoach.co.uk. That will also be linked in this week's show notes. Andrew, this season, season 3, we set out to look at the world of work, really the intersection of employers and employees in relation to neurodiversity. And whilst I think we've only just scratched the surface, we've had some fantastic guests and learned some really interesting things. For me, there have been some recurring themes, but I'd love to hear from you. What are your biggest takeaways from the season?
My biggest takeaways is that we've come a long way, and there's much, but we've still got so much to do from the employer's perspective. And now I think it feels comfortable now, to be honest, from speaking to people from the employee side, the neurodiverse person. But we've got to make sure that the workforce, the employer, understands how they need to adapt to embrace that change. And also understand that the benefits so far outweigh the negative sides of it. And I think on a note of diversity in itself, it's just so important to embrace all diversity in all its forms. And I think this podcast has done really well when getting that across.
I think we've really taken the Invisible Gift to the next level.
Yeah, and I think that the Invisible Gift is going to carry on growing with this point. And the things we've learned from this season is going to take us into the next episodes. I'm really excited about it.
We're taking a couple of weeks break now.
Yes.
Whilst we regroup. Have a little think about what we do next.
Yeah.
But we'll be back in a matter of weeks.
Yes, we will.
And we will be continuing the journey of the Invisible Gift.
Yes, until then, guys, please reach out and give us any feedback you can. We're really excited.
If in the meantime, if you haven't listened to seasons 1 and 2, absolutely go and do that. If you'd like to share your feedback with us, drop us an email or a voice note attachment to an email. Where should they send that, Andrew?
My email address is andrew@theinvisiblegift.com. Or you could just search any social media and hit me up with a direct message.
That sounds fabulous. I've enjoyed this season. Thank you for having me along. And I look forward to seeing you in a few weeks' time.
Thank you for being a co-host.
Okay, over and out.
Just a couple of quick notes before we go. They're important ones. You've been listening to the Invisible Gift podcast, presented by me, Andrew Kitley, and produced by One Fine Play. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Special thanks to Christina, Izzy, and the Cube Studios. Thank you for listening to the Invisible Gift podcast.